Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Barracuda Networks, innovators of network security and data protection solutions designed to thwart cyber threats and data loss for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at barracuda.com/KQED.
Justice and love won today.
A celebration at San Francisco City Hall Friday morning, kicking off Gay Pride weekend with a landmark Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. Today on the California Report, what now for the gay rights movement? Also, farmers are having to make do with less and less water, but it turns out there's a whole lot of stuff you can grow with nothing but rainwater, even in a drought.
40 or 50 years ago, we were all dry farming here in the California Hills. You know, everybody dry farmed almonds and walnuts and grapes and some fruit trees.
It's kind of back to the future with dry farming. Also, a big change of thinking in how to treat patients with dementia. What happens when nursing homes wean older patients off antipsychotic meds?
My sister came to visit, and she used my sister's name and clearly recognized her, which we had not seen in the years that she was on the medication.
I'm Scott Schaefer. It's the California Report. Sometimes it's hard to know when you're witnessing history until after the fact. But Friday morning, there was no question that the U.S. Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states was a landmark moment.
Look what you did! Look what you did! Today, America walks the talk.
Attorney Kate Kendall from the National Center for Lesbian Rights was one of the speakers outside San Francisco City Hall Friday morning. Hundreds of people turned out to celebrate the moment, including Karen Roy.
This means so much to us. We are legitimate. We can go anywhere in this country and be just like everybody else. This is so cool. And those that have that right just don't understand how important it is. But it is incredibly important just to be like everybody else.
A giant rainbow-colored flag draped down the front of City Hall from the mayor's balcony. Cars went by, drivers honking their approval. There were lots of little kids there, too. And you could almost tell that Justice Anthony Kennedy was thinking about them and their parents when he wrote the decision legalizing gay marriage everywhere. Without the recognition, stability, and predictability marriage offers, Justice Kennedy wrote, their children suffer the stigma of knowing their families are somehow lesser. That idea seemed to resonate with Sonny Schwartz.
It's a beautiful day in America. We're just so celebratory.
Why did you decide to come down to City Hall?
To be with people who invest in happiness and goodness and justice, and for our beautiful daughter to see the glory and the joy of decency.
Others, like Renata Moreira, were thinking of the world their kids will grow up in.
My wife and I are prospective parents, and I'm just thrilled to know that the world that our kids are going to be coming into, our family is already going to be protected.
For San Francisco city officials, past and present, this was a victory lap. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom was mayor 11 years ago when he broke the law and let same-sex couples marry.
I can't go a week, I don't care where I am, and someone comes up to me that was touched or connected by this issue and expresses gratitude and with tears in their eyes. And, you know, it's what it's about. Excuse me. It's the journey we've all been on together. And that's what it's all about. What an extraordinary thing to be part of.
But Newsom acknowledged that even a landmark ruling like this won't necessarily change the minds of folks who think gay marriage is just wrong.
When we overturned the interracial marriage bans in 1967, that didn't stop Charleston. And today's ruling is not going to stop people that are homophobic or bigoted from lashing out against the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. And so while it's right to celebrate the moment, it's also important to pause and reflect upon a court decision doesn't change people's hearts. That's going to take time.
Four Supreme Court justices wrote dissents that were at times stinging and surprisingly personal. Justice Antonin Scalia called the decision a threat to democracy because judges were making decisions that should be made by the people and their legislators. Chapman Law School professor John Eastman endorsed that idea.
The decision is illegitimate, and I think it's not constitutionally driven. The courts have imposed their view. There needs to be a reaction against it, and I suspect there will. In many states that have long adhered and recently reconfirmed their dedication to man-woman marriage, they will be there will be protests. There will be decisions not to enforce this this Supreme Court invalid decision. And I suspect there will be a constitutional amendment underway to restore the natural understanding of the institution of marriage.
But that may be wishful thinking, says UC Hastings law professor Rory Little. He sees very little daylight in the 5-4 decision that opponents of same-sex marriage could use.
This opinion is very unambiguous, very clear. There's no separate opinions in that five-justice majority. They all agree with what Justice Kennedy wrote.
For all the joy and cheers at City Hall Friday, there was still a sense that as big a victory as this ruling is, it's not the end of the road toward equality. For example, in most states, people can still be fired from their jobs just for being gay. Law professor Rory Little says while this Supreme Court decision doesn't directly affect issues like that, it could be used down the road.
This ruling is going to increase the protection in other areas because the recognition of equal dignity in the eyes of the law is not limited to just marriage. It's going to be extended. So I think you're going to see housing discrimination, job discrimination, other discriminations. They're going to be more strongly protective.
President Obama reacted to the ruling, saying it makes our union a little more perfect. There was another big ruling this week from a state superior court, and it could have wide-reaching implications for the use of antipsychotic drugs in nursing homes. The court found some facilities are overreaching in making medical decisions for certain patients. The ruling follows a decline in the use of these drugs over the past 3 years as nursing homes adhere to new federal rules. But some health experts say there is still a very long way to go. KQED's Rachel Dornhelm looked at how some facilities have learned to help patients without medication.
Diane Schoenfeld has a proud smile on her face as she introduces me to her aunt.
This is my aunt, Lily Manger. She is 97. She was born in 1917 in New York City.
The two are sitting in the dining room at Chaparral House, a nursing home in Berkeley. Manger is in a wheelchair, her white hair pulled back in a bun and tied with a scarf, an homage to the dancer she once was. Schoenfeld pulls out an album of her aunt at an art exhibit.
You have the paintings in your room and the drawings. Do you ever do artwork?
Do I ever do artwork?
Yes.
I love it.
Schoenfeld prompts her aunt about the other things she enjoys these days.
What are the things that you love?
That I love?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I love that. I love staying.
Schoenfeld is not disturbed by the cries.
It's okay, Aunt Lil. It's okay.
What?
Well, you're crying out. Do you know that you're crying out? Something is bothering you, and it's okay.
Schoenfeld had filled me in on Manger's story. This is the second nursing home where she's lived. In the first, staff notes recommended an antipsychotic sedative for behavior like crying out and outbursts. Schoenfeld wasn't thrilled, but agreed.
Maybe she'd be better cared for if, you know, if they give her that as opposed to being unhappy with her behavior.
2 years later, Schoenfeld had moved her aunt to Chaparral House to have her closer. By this time, Manger appeared to be in a fog. Eventually, Schoenfeld broached the idea of weaning her aunt from the medication. As soon as they did, she says things turned around.
I could see her personality again. I was so happy. My sister came to visit, and she used my sister's name and clearly recognized her, which we had not seen in the years that she was on the medication.
Schoenfeld says it just didn't feel right to have her aunt sedated.
If a baby is crying, I mean, most people will go to a baby and comfort them. They won't try to ignore them and drug them.
KJ Page, administrator of Chaparral House, shares that philosophy. Paige says in the early 2000s, she read a book about bathing dementia patients and why it can be such a challenge.
So it was all counterintuitive to them. A person they didn't know, couldn't recognize, comes take off their clothes. Ah, no wonder they're screaming and fighting and kicking.
Paige says after that aha moment, their staff agreed. It's not like the residents were running marathons every day. So they began giving simple sponge baths with a familiar caregiver. Paige says the results were inspiring.
It just rolled into, well, what else are they fighting for? And why do we need to have a fight? So what can we do to make it easier for people and easier for the staff? And so that's how we kind of approached it from that angle on.
It worked. Not one of Chaparral House's dementia patients is taking antipsychotics. That's an unusual figure. In California nursing homes, just over 15% of dementia patients are on these drugs, far more than advocates say is necessary. But the good news is that number is actually down from almost 22% just 3 years ago. That's when the federal government began regulating their use for dementia in nursing homes. After several studies warned, the medicines had serious risks, including strokes, falls, and death. Changing a staff's approach, though, requires different training. Enter Caroline Stevens, a professor at UCSF who specializes in psychiatric care for the elderly and long-term care policy.
But I think staff, I think it's been a very positive impact because they're now realizing that we don't have to necessarily reach for the medication, and they're actually getting to think creatively about what we can do for this resident.
I meet Stevens at Hayward Healthcare and Wellness Center, one of the nursing homes where she has consulted over the years. Stevens tells me about a success story helping a dementia patient who was always fighting to leave their facility at 5 o'clock.
They felt they needed to catch the bus. They needed to get home because they needed to take care of their daughter. And so we put a sign on the door that just said, buses aren't running today, it's a holiday. And we were able to kind of redirect the person.
And avoid using antipsychotic medications. Stephen says asking questions about people's pasts and giving purpose to patients often solves many disruptive behaviors. She says she'll introduce me to a resident who exemplifies this. But we don't go to his room. We head outside. Marcial Sandoval is wearing a big sun hat and work gloves and proudly shows me his volunteer badge.
Golden Daddy.
Stevens tells me that Sandoval entered the facility taking several antipsychotics and acting combative. Now he's on very small doses of the medications and spends almost his whole day outside gardening.
Me like the garden, like the vegetables.
He tells me this is who ranchero. He is, a ranchero.
I lived before in ranch.
Stephen says the federal regulations have led to great strides, with plenty of room still for nursing home improvement. The next frontier, she says, regulating the drugs use for dementia in assisted living and home care.
I think that that's definitely where we're headed.
Stevens does worry about some unintended consequences of the current policy. For one, she's seen some residents who do require antipsychotics, like people with schizophrenia, getting them mistakenly taken away. Also, she says facilities might cherry-pick dementia patients who are not on these medications. But there are few detractors of the patient-centered care these rules usher in. It's easy to see why, looking at the experience of Diane Schoenfeld and her aunt. At Chaparral House, they connect over a family album. Schoenfeld points out a picture of Menger as a young woman.
That's me.
That's you.
Am I supposed to remember?
I don't know if you're supposed to. It's okay either way.
For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
Most of us are trying to cut down our water use, right? Well, at least we're supposed to be. Farmers have taken a big hit, too. Big cuts in water allocations from the government. Farming with less water, it's a challenge for sure. But try farming without irrigation, relying only on rainwater. Well, it turns out lots of crops, like wheat and grapes, are dry farmed across the state. There are tomatoes on the Central Coast, squash in Humboldt, and walnuts in San Luis Obispo County. That's where Lisa Morehouse picks up the story for the series California Foodways.
Let me tell you this up front. This is not a drought story with a lot of different perspectives and opinions. This is a story about an advocate. Yuta Turner and her partner Cynthia Douglas own Manzanita Manor Organics. They have solar panels running their coolers and sheep grazing their vineyards. At their walnut orchard, Turner only gets a tractor out twice a year. Mostly, she uses horses.
Come, G. Good boy. Come on, Lily.
Today, they're pulling a large log behind a wagon to smooth out the ground.
We want to get this as smooth and as flat as we possibly can. No big clumps.
This process will help keep moisture underground and make harvesting easier.
Ideally, we want it like glass. A little difficult on these hills, but we try.
Does it. All part of her process of dry farming, using no irrigation ever on her trees.
What that means is whatever rain comes down from the sky is the water that they're getting.
People have farmed this way for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
40 or 50 years ago, we were all dry farming here in the California hills. You know, everybody dry farmed almonds and walnuts and grapes and some fruit trees.
Before irrigation came in and people planted crops more densely on all types of soil. Turner says dry farming's a good fit for coastal or foggy areas, less so for huge operations in sandy soil. But if farmers have the right soil and the right conditions,
it can be done on other properties. And who knows, maybe this drought will make that happen.
Dry farming's not about crossing your fingers and hoping for rain. Turner keeps her trees spaced far apart so they don't compete for water. She monitors the weather and cultivates the soil. Then she creates a dust mulch or seal, like she was doing with her horses and that log. While workers trim trees by hand, Turner explains that she has to graft two kinds of walnuts together to get the best results. The variety on top, which grows a delicious walnut, is grafted onto a different, hardier stock, whose roots are great at finding water underground.
They are fantastic as a dry farmed rootstock. They go to China, those roots. They go so, so deep.
And these last few dry years, Turner and workers protected the grafted branches by wrapping them in cages of chicken wire covered in shade cloth.
It looks ridiculous, but it works.
But the drought definitely makes dry farming harder.
Unfortunately, with the way the weather has been, my production of walnuts has been going down steadily every year.
Turner and I walk to a tree where she looks for examples of doubles, sets of two walnuts in clusters, which can mean a better yield.
Okay, look, right here, above us. Right here. Every farmer likes to see doubles, but we really like to see are triplets. And there, Lisa found a triplet! Yay! So see, that's cool. I have not seen triplets in a few years.
Despite that find, I can see the orchard suffering. Some trees have dead branches, and the walnuts, which are always smaller than the ones from irrigated orchards, are really tiny this year. Many are just a little bigger than my thumb. We go into a shelling shed where her walnuts go through several rounds in a cracking machine. These small nuts taste sweet and buttery, but Turner says lately, tree breeders have focused most on developing varieties that produce big walnuts that crack easily and fall out in perfect halves. That's a silly standard, she says, when people are just going to chop them up into salads and cookies anyway.
Whatever happened to taste, people?
About 40 miles west, farmer Mike Cerrone says his farmer's market customers are becoming connoisseurs of his small, sweet, dry-farmed fruit.
They're like, hey, do you have any of those dry-farmed apricots?
Same goes for the 60 varieties of apples he farms without irrigation.
If you pump them all up, they tend to all taste the same. But when you let them kind of do their own thing, and then it really accentuates the unique flavor of each variety.
Cerrone digs his boot heel into dry topsoil, revealing moisture underneath.
See, it's damp right down here.
He's been successfully dry farming for over 30 years and made it through a drought in the 80s pretty well.
The difference was this drought is warm. This drought feels like we're living in Palm Springs in the middle of winter. To me, that is the most unsettling notion, because that signifies real climate change to me.
If the drought continues and if the global warming continues, I don't want people to stop farming.
Yuta Turner says yes. The profits aren't as big in dry farming, but she hopes some small growers will consider converting rather than giving up. She's most hopeful that young farmers will hear this message.
All they know is the drought. The new generation, that is not afraid to try new things, I want to tell them, just dry farm. And you absolutely can make a living if you work your behind off.
She says, just find a piece of land with good soil and do it. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in San Luis Obispo County.
And Lisa Morehouse produced that story while at a residency at the Mesa Refuge. The Bay Area has long been a haven for creative musicians, and the Red Poppy Art House in San Francisco's Mission District has been one of the places fostering up-and-coming artists. Two very different musicians, both with deep roots at the Red Poppy, have recently caught the attention of the California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert, their singer Tiffany Austin, and accordion player Rob Reich. Here are his reviews of the latest releases from the two, starting with Austin's Nothing But Soul.
Tiffany Austin's debut album, Nothing But Soul, relies on a time-tested strategy that alto sax great Jackie McLean once described as new wine in old bottles. The project evolved out of a 2013 concert exploring the songs of Hoagy Carmichael. She and saxophonist Howard Wiley came up with arrangements that refurbish some of Carmichael's best-loved songs to fit the luxuriant contours of her voice.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time.
A smart and unaffected singer, Austin swings stardust, transforming the ballad without diluting the power of Carmichael's soaring melody.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie.
The album's most unexpected track is her barrel house sprint through Johnny Cash's I Walk the Line, a tune that Carmichael evidently covered back in 1956. Just like Hoagy's standards, she makes the song her own with a combination of rhythmic panache and unabashed intelligence.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. Keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds.
Reimagining standards is just one facet of Austin's creativity. She spent a year as artist-in-residence at San Francisco's Red Poppy Art House, putting her own spin on songs gleaned from early Creole recordings from Louisiana. Nothing But Soul is an impressive debut. But where Austin employs a canny strategy in approaching familiar material, Oakland accordionist Rob Reich merely has to play a few notes to establish his singular identity. A versatile composer best known for his work in Tin Hat, he delivers a dozen original compositions on his entrancing new album, Shadowbox, a realm where the accordion sheds many, but not all, of its old-world connotations. That's Night Heron, a tune that embodies so much of what makes Reich's music memorable and evocative. There's the subway rumble of Ben Goldberg's contra alto clarinet, Todd Sickafoose's elastic bass lines, Eric Garland's subtle but assertive cymbal touch, and guitarist Isla Cantor's ominous notes that hang in the air. Reich plays piano on several tracks too, but it's the tunes that pair his accordion with Goldberg's clarinet that I keep coming back to. Like How Now, a piece that makes me think of Thelonious Monk walking through the countryside in Eastern Europe. With the accordion serving as Reich's primary instrumental muse, Shadowbox introduces a chamber folk sound that seems ripe for further exploration.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Tiffany Austin's Nothing But Soul and Shadowbox by Rob Reich. And finally today, another in our occasional series we call My Spot. That's where we celebrate personal experiences with special places across California. Today we head out on a run with a librarian to explore her home away from home, Annadel State Park in Santa Rosa.
This is Rebecca Forth, and I'm 41. It is not a complete week unless I get up here to run or hike. It's right in the middle of Santa Rosa, but it feels like you're in the wilderness. I've seen owls and turkeys, rattlesnakes of all sizes, coyotes, all sorts of birds. We just had a group pass us that probably about 8 15-year-olds with music heading up to the lake. There are runners like myself. There are hikers, mountain bikers. It really feels like there's a community that has coalesced around this place. We are up at the top of the first hill, and we've ascended about 1,000 feet, and we are looking out on Lake Il San Joe. It's brilliantly blue right now. You can hear some swimmers in the background.
It's really slippery.
I feel like this has almost become my living room. I think it may sound a little trite to say that I feel really connected, but I do. I feel like this is my place. I feel like the people who I run into up here are my people. I just feel at home.
Rebecca Forth was interviewed by Michelle Dutro. You can listen to this piece again and other stories in the series online at californiareport.org. And that is a wrap for this week's California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes David Weir, David Marks, Lisa Pickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price. This week, we say goodbye and good luck to our interns, Michelle Dutro and Pyle Zaveri, and welcome to our new interns, Laura Clivens and Natalia Estrada. Lisa Alafaris was a contributing editor. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Tyke Hendricks, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, and Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
California Foodways is made possible with support from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Visit www.calhum.org. Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of children at risk in California.